There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Ramadan Kareem from Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is the Business Breakfast Nightcap with Brandy Scott.
And if you've been listening to Dubai Eye this week, you will know that two Dubai residents have just successfully summited Mount Everest. One of them, Dolores Al-Shaleh, has become the first Arab woman, in fact, the first Jordanian, to scale the mountain from its technically tricky North Col. It has been a particularly deadly season on the mountain this year, with a suspected 10 climber deaths. And as you're going to hear in just a few minutes, Dolores actually witnessed one of them during her own climb. But she began by telling me this evening why she wanted to climb Mount Everest in the first place. Just to let you know, the quality of the audio does drop off in a few moments, and that's because I actually spoke to her while she was coming down the mountain. This is Dolores Al-Shaleh.
First of all, I think it's a huge, huge, huge challenge for me as a woman, also an Arab woman coming from Jordan. Through my climb and also my previous climbs, I'm raising awareness for the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, especially climate action, gender equality, and the importance of sustainable cities and communities. And I really wanted to share this message to the world and the audience and the people who are following me and seeing what I'm doing through my journey and climb to Everest, because I know this is how I'm getting attention, and that this is how I can give the message for these things.
What did you have to do in the way of training?
First of all, I had to climb other mountains. For the training, I used to train more than 2 hours a day, in the morning time and in the evening time, every day, constantly. A lot of cardio and resistance training. And before I made the step to climb Mount Everest, I climbed Mount Manaslu, world's eighth highest mountain. And I was also the first Arab woman or man to climb that mountain, which is 8,156 meters. So I think that was my biggest preparation for Everest.
How do you train to climb a mountain here in Dubai? How do you train for altitude and for temperature?
I'm a bit different in that way because I don't really go to mountains many times. Sometimes I go on small hikes, and Ras Al Khaimah and stuff. But usually it's more of gym training, personal training. I think climbing a mountain is more mental than physical, to be honest with you, especially high mountains, high altitude mountains. I also had a high altitude tent in my room, so I used to sleep in it sometimes. I haven't used it much, but I think it did help me with the muscle memory.
I understand that the way you summited is actually one of the hardest ways, using the North Col. Tell me about why you chose to do that.
I chose the North Col because it has less traffic, to be honest. I knew that it's a bit harder because it's windier, it's a bit more technical, the rocky side of it, let's say, because usually the south side has more snow and ice and stuff like that. I found it really difficult on the way down more than the way up. On the summit day also, from the north side, it was minus 37 on our summit day. I summited on May 23rd.
You mentioned that the north side was less crowded, and we've heard a lot in the news over the last couple of days about how dangerous it has been in Everest this season. Now that you're safely down, I feel we can talk about the fact that there have been a number of deaths in the past.
Yes.
10 days on Everest. Did you hear about any of them while you were up there?
I have actually seen a man die in front of me on the second step from the North Col. It's a very known area in the North Col. Usually climbers, this is where they fall or accidents happen. And this is where they found the body of George Mallory, the first guy to attempt Everest, the three expeditions of Everest, long time ago. So it's more about the technical parts going down from the North Col.
There's been a lot of discussion about whether or not Everest is becoming too crowded, and whether the numbers of people going up in those sort of those windows of good weather are making it more dangerous. How do you feel about that?
as I mentioned before, the south side is more dangerous because of the traffic jam, and it's more commercial and it's easy to go there. The north call is harder because of the visa process with the Chinese. So not anyone can access the north call. The north call only a couple of hundred climbers. We were like 100 and something climbers, I think, summiting the same day. And the south side, you're talking about, I think, more than 400 climbers. So that's the bad side about the south and the good side about the north. So there's always pros and cons to both of them.
But you did still, I mean, you saw a man die in front of you. I can't even imagine what that's like while you're climbing.
Yeah, I was the only one who witnessed that because the members that were standing in line, they were on top of the rock. They can't see anything, and I'm the only one who can see on the top and who can see on the bottom what's happening in the middle, going down from the second step. For me, it was I was traumatized, to be honest. I panicked. And I had to pass the body of the dead guy. Like, a guide came and he pushed him to the side after he died. And then I had to be the first person to go down the same steps he went down from the second step. So for me, that was a very hard thing to do. And my energy got drowned. And that day, I got really tired and exhausted going down from the summit. And it took me a long time. And I almost felt like giving up that night. Because we have to go to the lower camps. We can't stay at the higher camps. It's dangerous to stay up high in the high altitude for a long time after the summit. Yeah, I was in good hands. That's why I came safely. If I wasn't in good hands, I don't think I would have made it.
Do you think there needs to be a limit on the number of climbers who can go up Everest every year?
Yes, I think so. And I think there should be more restrictions, more details. There should be more restrictions about that, the amount of experience and stuff like that. So the North Col, usually the people are more experienced than the South side.
What kind of decision did you have to make yourself to go up in terms of the risks? How do you weigh that up personally for yourself, for your family?
I trained for it. I read about it a lot. I met a lot of Everest climbers. I chose the right expedition leader. I made sure to know what kind of background they have and their history, the climbers that climbed with them before and what happened. And of course, I knew there is always going to be a risk. There's always a risk in everything in life. So that was always my answer when people tell me, are you crazy? What are you doing? And stuff like that. If you love what you do, if you believe in what you do, if you're trying to reach a goal and inspire other youth and women and people around you, and you actually love what you're doing, then you should pursue it. This is how I thought about it. And I was always positive about it.
One of the things you wanted to promote with your climb was the sustainable development goals and an environmental message.
Yes.
Did you see much evidence of sort of human rubbish, human litter left behind on the mountain?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Thank you for asking that. From the North Col, they're very strict with their regulations, as I said before. So there isn't rubbish around. And also during the climb, like when we were trekking from the camp, from the base camp to the higher camps, there were stations where you can put all the trash in it. So I think this is a really good thing about the North Col, that it's very clean, it's very neat. There was also another expedition, Chinese expedition, I think, who were also cleaning up the mountain or going around to check if it's clean or not. I was trying to get information, but we had the language barrier. But I think that from the south side, there should be more restrictions because I heard that there's a lot of rubbish and also the dead bodies and all of that. And it's really hard to clean the mountains on high altitudes and get all that trash down. And it's very sad if we don't take care of the environment and the mountains, that the other generations are not going to experience what we're experiencing now. This is how I look at it. It's just so beautiful. It's challenging, but it's the most beautiful thing in the world to be in nature and to be in a magic place and a place that's clean and not really touched by human beings.
So what's next for you, Dolores?
Hopefully, I want to finish the seven summits. I will have another four of the highest contests in the world to finish. And I will continue doing what I'm doing. And through that, I still want to keep raising awareness for the climate action, gender equality, and the importance of sustainable cities and communities. I'm a part of the Sustainable City in Dubai. They are. I want to thank them because they are the believer and they're the support behind what I just did and accomplished, because I had to prove that women can reach their goals and pursue them. And I want to keep doing that constantly and not stop.
And that's Dolores El Shelley, who has become the first Arab woman to scale Mount Everest from its tricky north col. She mentioned Sustainable City there in her day job, and she's not climbing mountains. She's actually communications officer at Diamond Developers, the company behind it. Coming up in just a few minutes on The Business Breakfast, we're going to go from climbing mountains to building businesses. We're going to hear from one new Dubai business leader who's gone from surviving on £3 a day to building several multi-million dollar businesses, and he's only 29. That's next.
Ramadan Kareem from Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is the Business Breakfast Nightcap. You're listening to Brandy Scott.
You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap, and I can't wait to get started with my next interview. I am this month getting to know some of Dubai's most fascinating business people and learning what makes them tick. And tonight I am joined by Chris Schutrips, who is the managing director of Mortgage Finder. It's part of Property Finder here in the UAE. He's a relatively new Dubai resident, but one with an incredible story to tell. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about where you come from first. Let's talk about your background. Tell me a little bit about where you were born and how you grew up.
So I was born in Perth in Scotland. My father is Dutch, so I'm 2 metres, so they're the tallest nation in the world, and my mother's English. I was born, as you said, in 1990, so I'm 29. I was born right after the recession of the late 80s. My parents had started from nothing a hotel. And had gone bankrupt, and we ended up with nothing. So we lived in Scotland till I was 4. As you mentioned in the intro, we lived, 8 of us plus our 4 pets, on £3 a day. You know, my father was a good inspiration, or is a good inspiration, of a man who worked hard. He used to go out and buy a loaf of bread and make sandwiches and go and sell them at the local factories to try and just make enough money to pay the rent. And then at the age of 4, I moved to Southampton, where I've lived ever since moving to Dubai in January.
What does surviving on £3 a day look like?
Oh, I think it's pretty, you know, I think it's pretty tough, is the truth. My parents worked extremely hard to try and create a better life for us. When you work, and I think that's something that's really important to remember, is when you're in a community where the economy relies on one employer. So we see that actually British Steel last week, who may or may not close, large car manufacturers in the UK, when a whole community in the supply chain rely on one employer and they close, it can be absolutely catastrophic to the people around it. And that's definitely what my family felt at the time. So,
what was the industry that closed in Perth?
It was a local factory. I can't remember if I'm pretty sure it was in food, but it was a local factory. But my father's hotel, you know, the guests who came to the factory, the business executive stayed there. The local employees came for drinks and food and the business lunch. And so when it closed, the employees didn't have any money. A high percentage of the community were either employed or involved in the supply chain, and no one visited anymore. And that's a really difficult position to be in with any business, I think.
And so you moved down to Southampton, still in the recession though, no?
Yeah. So my father is a pretty incredible story, really. And one, again, is a good lesson for me, for sure, which is he had lived in Southampton prior to going to Scotland, and he was the general manager of a 4-star, 5-star hotel. And he came back, he sent out 300 CVs and couldn't find a job. He ended up being the night porter washing the dishes below everyone who had used to work underneath him. And I think that is something that is commendable, really, because it's, I would imagine, a pretty hard thing to do. So, you know, at that point, my mum and dad shared a bus pass. My dad worked nights. They would meet at the bus stop with me, swap the bus pass, and I would go home. So, and that was really where they had to start again, really, from scratch.
What did you learn about money from that?
It's a very good point. I think I can look back on how they used to manage their money, which was all cash. And I think that's something that maybe in our society today, you know, I know for sure I'm sat here with a credit card in my pocket, but no money. The reality is that they used to budget the cash, break it down, separate it. And, you know, although it sounds like a very small amount of money, they still managed to, well, I'm still here. So they managed to make it through and make it work. So I think I probably learnt more about hard work and determination there as well.
Did it affect what you wanted to do or be with your life?
No, I don't think so. I didn't really know what I wanted to do until I found my first job in finance, if I'm honest. I probably had a pretty lost journey through education in not really knowing exactly what I wanted to be or achieve. And up until I started work, really the only thing I was good at was trying to tell a joke.
Well, I understand that you had a number of small businesses going while you were at school.
Yeah, that's right. I had a couple of businesses. One was I bought off of eBay these, they were called signal boosters. They went behind your phone battery and they were meant to increase your signal. And I bought them for 2p each off of eBay. And then I sold them for 50p each in the playground. And when I got to capacity of how many people I could sell to, I basically, I suppose you'd call it multi-level marketing nearly now, but I used to give my friends 25p for everyone that they sold. And that worked really well. I also in primary school bought a briefcase and took £20, bought £20 worth of sweets and then sold them for £40 and kept that going until the head teacher told my parents I wasn't allowed to bring sweets in a briefcase to school anymore, understandably.
Then you were off to college.
Yes.
But it didn't last long.
No, I went to a college where actually I didn't know a huge amount of people. So that was really good for making new friends because you don't stick within a social circle and you meet people in lots of different circles. But that socialness was my downfall, if you like. And about 3 months in, college professor said to me, look, I think you should probably restart next year and just go away and work out what you want to do, which was something that I realised was true. But having an extremely firm Dutch father, it was also a difficult conversation to have that I had dropped out of college and one that disappointed my mother and father greatly at the time.
So what did you do?
Well, there was only one thing in my mind that I could do, which was go and get a job. So I had a little bit of pocket money because I worked the mornings as a waiter in a hotel. And so I went to Primark, a local store in the UK, bought the cheapest suit for £30 and at the time went around all the recruitment agencies because they still had high street stores and asked for a job. And I took the first job that I got, which was about a week later with HSBC in the call centre in Southampton. And that's where my career started.
In financial products?
Yeah, essentially I worked in a call centre on a sales team where we took inbound calls for people who were looking for loans, credit cards. And it was before the financial crisis. Everyone got approved. And it was honestly a great job. And I went through the first 4 weeks of training, still being maybe not the most focused on what I was trying to achieve. And then I went onto the telephones and out of the 400 people in the call centre, I was up there near the top. And for the 6 months that I was there, I was pretty much number one for sales. And it was a great feeling, a great experience. And that led me on to my career as a stockbroker in the City of London.
Why do you think you were good in the call centre? Why do you think you were good at selling over the phone?
It's a great question. I say to teams that I run, sales is just transfer of enthusiasm from one person to another. And as a 16-year-old boy, you know, I was super energetic about the bank. The customers had a need for the personal loans generally. They wanted a new car, a kitchen, whatever it may be. And being in a role where most people got approved was also a great role because you always said yes and made people's, if you like, without sounding cheesy, their dreams of getting a new kitchen or a new holiday or whatever it may be, a reality. So, yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. I didn't really see it as sales, more as just providing a service.
You mentioned there very briefly that you ended up in the City of London after
that. Yeah, that's right.
How did that happen?
I actually remember it distinctly. I was having my hair cut in Southampton and I got a call from, you know, in a lot of ways it could be compared to many of the blockbuster Hollywood's movies that look at stockbroking. I got a call from a guy who was to be my boss, a chap called Callum Hill, still a friend of mine now, and he called me up and sounded incredible on the phone, said to me, look, can you get up to London tomorrow? We want to interview you. And so I jumped on a train. I went up there. I knew nothing about the stock market. I knew nothing about business at all. And they said, look, you can start the job, but it's £15,000, which was less than I was being paid significantly. You need to be here at 7:30 every morning and you don't leave until you're finished, which normally will be 8 p.m. And it was at least 2 hour each way commute as well. So it was a pretty tough job. When you were going through your training to be a stockbroker, so to get your qualification, you had to essentially set up new clients for the senior brokers. That involved making at least 400 calls a day with no chair. It wasn't...
You were standing?
Yeah, and I'm 6'7", as I said, so I was standing, bending over. It wasn't
6'7".
6'7". There's no like dialers that people have now in sales team where it automatically dials. It was a bit of paper, really cold data. You made these calls. Most of the people told you to get on your bike when you called them. And it was definitely think that was the number one job which taught me what real hard work is, because I went home every night with a bad back from bending over and dialing so many numbers and absolutely drained. And by the time I got to the weekend, you know, I basically couldn't function. I needed to sleep the whole weekend. So it was a good job in a lot of ways, taught me a lot of lessons and continued me on my journey.
So why are you not a stockbroker now?
I think it was a moral decision for me. The company that I worked for dealt with a lot of small cap shares, which are the more illiquid stocks. You have to invest across a diverse range in a portfolio like that. And it's unlikely that you'll see a lot of them achieve amazing numbers. So I suppose, put simply, a lot of the clients' money would not ever appreciate to the amount that they necessarily wanted. And so actually, one day I called a potential client and he was a director under my uncle. I thought to myself then, look, I don't know if I'm comfortable with this guy putting his money in. And it was that moment when I realised how I felt about it, really, that I thought to myself, this probably isn't where I want to be. And so I handed in my notice the next day, pretty much, came back to Southampton and quickly got a job as a retail manager for Royal Bank of Scotland.
I'm speaking this evening to Chris Shoetrips. He's a man who's gone from a family that lived on £3 a day, not very long ago, because he's only 29, to running his own multi-million pound business, more than one business, actually, it must be said. We're hearing about that journey this night on the Business Breakfast Nightcap. More to come.
Ramadan Kareem from Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is the Business Breakfast Nightcap with Brandy Scott,
where I am speaking this evening to Chris Shoetrips. He's a relatively new Dubai resident. He arrived here just at the beginning of 2019 to run Mortgage Finder, part of Property Finder. Personally, he's got a fascinating journey of building his own fortune, really building his own business. We were just having a chat a moment ago, Chris, about the fact that you started out as a stockbroker very young. You're still very young.
Yeah.
But it wasn't for you because you had issues from a moral point of view. Where do you think you got that moral compass from?
It's a good question. I think I really don't know. My parents have very good morals behind them, I guess. So I've always been raised to be honest and truthful, and I'm quite aware of people's emotions. And so, yeah, I think it's an inner-built thing where I ultimately everything that I do. And that's why I like mortgages, because you don't really sell the customer something, they need the mortgage, you generally sell them the service, is the truth. Whereas when you sell them investments, there's a lot of cowboys out there. There's also some great ones, don't get me wrong. I think I'm quite emotionally aware, and I always want people to think the best of me, I suppose.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a moment, because there are people who will be raising their eyebrows at the idea of, you know, getting people the mortgages they need as being an altruistic service.
Well, I suppose what we do as brokers is if a consumer's going to get a mortgage, we make sure that we compare. We're impartial. You know, my team at Mortgage Finder, there's very little compliance actually here in the UAE compared to the UK. So we make sure that we're culturally aligned, that we do the best thing for the consumer no matter what, so we don't focus on commission or fees or whatever it may be. All we want to do is, and what I want ingrained into anyone that I work with, is that we have the best customer outcome, because long term, that's what drives the businesses forward and gives them prospects over a longer period.
I've been trying to do the maths here as we've been talking.
Yeah.
And I've got you moving into the mortgage industry at about 18, 19 years old?
So I moved into retail banking. So I was a bank manager about 18.
You were a bank manager at 18?
Yeah, that's right. So I ran a branch in a place in Lymington in the New Forest. Lots of OAPs, pretty relaxed. And then I moved into mortgages probably about 20.
Were adults listening to you as an 18-year-old bank manager?
Well, it's a really good point, actually, because I went into a branch that also had a lot of underperformance. And that's really my first baptism by fire on how to manage people, because before that, I hadn't managed people. I didn't understand, rightfully, you point out the age thing. You know, I was managing people who had been in the bank for 30 years, seen people come and go. And so I worked out the only way that I could really make it a success was make sure that if I asked someone to do something, I did it myself and proved that it worked first. And that's something that I have continued through my career. It gives you, as you go on, you get a lot more credibility. But it was tough. And you know, you've just got to, as long as you don't have an ego and you're working as one team and people know that you've got your everyone's best interests at heart, then over time it becomes easier.
So why did you start your own business?
So actually I was a mortgage broker for a corporate estate agent. And the chap that I worked with, who was the branch manager, was going to start up his own estate agency. And he said, come along, you know, start a mortgage brokerage and you can do all of my mortgage business. And for the agent that I worked with, I was number one in the region, top 10 in the UK. And I thought, wow, I'm going to be driving a Bentley before I know it. This is going to be amazing. And so I started the business. I handed in my notice. And on the week that I started actually working in the business, he took an employed role elsewhere. And so suddenly I had not a lot of money, no clients, no leads, and I had no idea really on what I was going to do. And at that point, you know, that was a pretty challenging time to work out the way forward from there. It was 2011, roughly. And so it was just coming out of a recession still. The property market in the UK wasn't great. Mortgage advisors had gone from 27,000 advisors in the UK down to 8,000. So the market had contracted significantly. So it was definitely a challenging time to start a business from scratch, from a bedroom, with no money.
So what did you do?
Well, I'm pretty stubborn, so I was adamant that I wasn't going to go back to my old boss, who told me that it wasn't going to work, and asked for my job back. So I for the first 6 months, I went out and I knocked on estate agency doors, went out and asked for the business. As I'm sure we might talk about in a little bit, I was a volunteer police officer at the time. So I used to do a lot of mortgages for police officers. And so just kept myself ticking over from there. About 6 months in, actually, I went and had an interview with two local rivals. Actually, 5 years later, we actually acquired one of them and bought them out. But at that point, that was sort of the crossroads where probably my time in business could have been cut short.
Mortgage Hut now is what, 8 years old?
Yeah.
One of the top 10 mortgage brokers in the UK?
Yeah, that's correct.
How much is it worth now? Roughly.
Probably somewhere between £3 and £5 million.
And that's yours?
Yeah, that's right.
How does that feel, given your upbringing?
Yeah, no, it feels great. And I suppose I have to say, actually, the start of all of the stories involve me, but actually, like a business like The Mortgage Hut has an amazing team behind it now. So it's a collective of about 40 to 50 people's hard work that gives it that value that continues to drive it forward. But it feels great. It's not just the value side we create, and whether it be one of my businesses in the UK or one of the Mortgage Finder where I work here, it's the opportunities that it creates for people, the what it provides for people's families, for their prospects. And to know that you're making a difference is a really positive outcome from running businesses, for sure.
You mentioned one of your businesses. What other businesses have you got?
Yeah, so I also have a recruitment business, which I started when I was going through a real growth phase in the mortgage business, and I was spending so much money on recruitment costs. A friend of mine was coming back from a job actually in London as a recruitment consultant, and he said, I needed a job. And so that's where it started. I said, look, come work for me. You can do my recruitment and, you know, we'll build it from there. And now we're a specialist financial services business in the UK. We recruit for my business, my competitors. And it's a great small business that helps a lot of people again.
Hisham's just got in touch with us to ask if you ever got your Bentley.
I have a no. The short answer is no. But I do have a nice Range Rover that I'm pretty happy with. Yeah.
Do you treat yourself?
Definitely I treat myself. But I have worked hard to grow the business. I've reinvested a lot of profits because the money that I had to start the Mortgage Hut was £10,000. By the time I opened the doors, it was down to £4,000. I didn't get any income for the first six, nine months. I was only like £200 a month. So I've reinvested a lot. Grown it. I have some nice houses now and, you know, a comfortable lifestyle. But I think I live a really nice lifestyle and I'm very fortunate.
Are your parents still alive?
Yes, they are. Yeah. Yeah, they for sure. My father still works and my mother is retired. So, they are fighting fit.
What do they make of it all?
I think they're super proud. For sure, they're really proud. And that's one of the motivators, because money isn't the key motivator for me, if I'm honest. It's a byproduct. But, you know, doing my mum and dad proud is right there on the top of priorities of doing well in this life. And, I think I'm going on the right course at the moment with that, for sure.
You mentioned briefly there that you used to be a volunteer police constable.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
A good question. So actually, whilst I was working for NatWest, I also had a client who owned some nightclubs. And so I did him a favour being...
6 foot seven.
And not the slimmest guy in the world. I said to him, I'll do a couple of shifts as a doorman for you. And that evolved. And then I met some police officers and they said, you should do this. And that's what I did. It was super rewarding. You know, you train on the weekends over a 6 month period. In the UK, you can't really distinguish between what they call a special constable and a normal police constable. Because I did mortgages for some of the senior officers, I got some good positions as I moved up and got put onto a response team and then into what's known as an area car, which is the fastest response car. And then I got allocated to the dog unit for the final part, not with my own dog, but working with a dog handler. So it was really rewarding. You start off with really basic stuff, but lead up to some really high pressure situations where you have to make pretty dynamic risk assessments. So, I really, really enjoyed it.
How has it affected or how does it relate to the way you view business, having been obviously in life and death situations and another with the police?
Well, I think when you've been in those situations, any office, HR or IT issue or whatever it may be seems relatively insignificant. But what it did do was it gave me good ability to make quick decisions, I think. And That's a skill that definitely has helped me. It also helped me communicate, because we live in fairly sheltered lives. We don't know how the other half lives in a lot of ways. And so it definitely helped the way that I saw society. It helped me. It has two outcomes. It can either put a very negative spin on your outlook, or it can give you a positive spin on how you can help people. And so, it definitely helped me look at and communicate more effectively with a wider cross-section of society, for sure.
I'm speaking to Chris Jutrips this evening, a man who defines the term self-made. We're going to find out a little bit more about him and his leadership beliefs, his business style, in just a few moments here on the Business Breakfast Nightcap.
Ramadan Kareem from Dubai Eye 103.8.
This is the Business Breakfast Nightcap with Brandy Scott.
I'm speaking to Chris Jutrips. He's a man who went from poverty in Scotland, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying that, his family feeding eight people and a couple of animals on £3 a day, to running his own multi-million dollar business, owning his own multi-million dollar business. And now he's here.
Yes.
Got to say, at this point, he's also only 29, and I feel like we've heard a story this evening of someone much older. You came to Dubai at the beginning of 2019, moved here, for a job.
Yes.
As a man who owns a business that's worth, I forget what you said, somewhere between £3 and £5 million
in the UK?
Correct.
Yeah.
Why did you take a job?
Well, it's really interesting. I actually wasn't looking for a job. And one day I got approached last September on LinkedIn. And this is the power of social networking sites like LinkedIn. I got approached by a lady who worked for Property Finder Group. And she said, we've got this role, and gave me the job description. And I looked at it and I thought, well, actually, you know, that's pretty much what I do now, when I looked at the job description. So I thought, well, I'm not looking for a job, but maybe if I speak to them, they might refer business to my business in the UK so I can make some more money. So I said to her, look, I'm probably not interested, but more than happy to have a chat. And I spoke to the gentleman who recruited me, a very passionate Australian gentleman. And he, we were meant to speak for 15 minutes. We ended up speaking for over 4 hours. And he said, look, come out and see the business, see what it's about. And I came out and really fell in love with Mortgage Finder, is the truth. It's an absolutely fabulous business. And I had been unchallenged for the last year in my business in the UK. I hadn't pushed it as hard as in previous years, because actually Brexit was quite a concerning factor for me. We started this interview by saying about my father and him losing his business in the recession in the late 80s. So I'm always very aware of the impacts of recession and challenges. And so it seemed like the right opportunity, the right time. I had a good management team in my business in the UK. So I said to myself, look, come out. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. I had taken over a business in 2016 and brought it into mine. And the people who worked in that business made it a pretty challenging role for me to bring it in together. And I thought to myself, well, it probably is going to be something similar here. I'm going into a business that has a new manager, and you know, I have little credibility to them, where I need to prove myself. And actually, it's been a fabulous experience. The team that I took over, and one of the things in business that I think is always great is when you can create your own team. When you take on a team, it's a little bit more challenging, because you don't have that relationship, you haven't brought them in. But actually, the team that I have in Mortgage Finder are incredible. They're all great. They're very supportive of me. And we've seen the business over double in the first 6 months since I've been here. So it's been very similar to the journey that I went on with the Mortgage Hub. But this time I know the way a little bit more.
Yeah, but it's not yours, though. How do you go from being, you know, the boss?
Yeah, no, well, I have a very supportive board in Property Finder. They are very supportive of me. They allow me to have pretty free rein on the day-to-day runnings, allow me to do what I want. And so, you know, I'm super lucky. I essentially run a business that is nearly my own, with the same great challenges that I've experienced before. But I'm part of a bigger organisation as well. And from a personal development point of view, I'm learning a lot being part of a bigger group, because frankly, a year ago, I could have been unemployable for all I knew, being out of work, running my own business for the last 8 years. And as you point out, I'm still pretty young. I'm pretty ambitious, and I certainly want to do bigger and better things as time goes on. So the opportunity at Mortgage Finder is great. It's a great business, and there's here in the Dubai market, there's really a huge amount of opportunity for us to make a lot of difference to customers.
Pretty much every role you've stepped into in your brief 29 years on this planet, you have excelled at. You've turned businesses around. You've doubled their profits. Mm-hmm. You've made businesses out of absolutely nothing from your bedroom.
Yeah.
Why do you think you've been able to manage to do that?
I think it's, I'm sure that there's an element of luck in the roles that I've been in. But the truth is that it's about hard work. The teams that I run now, I think I have an element of credibility because I've done what they've done. I understand the model. Actually, although businesses are extremely complex and extremely very, very varied and different in how they run, actually, they're also pretty similar. And when you strip it back, you've got a product, you've got a service. If we take the example of a lot of the great tech ideas that are coming through now, I regularly speak to people when I go to conferences and speak to them about ideas that they have about a new tech product, an algorithm, some service, but they don't think about how you actually get consumers to that. That's in that example, that's the number one challenge that normally people find with businesses. So, I really enjoy it. I think as long as you work hard, you have a clear plan, you're able to have your team on board with you, then you can't really go too far wrong.
I think it's probably fair to say you're probably one of the nicest people I've ever interviewed. That's one of the things that has definitely come across in our chat this evening. Is there a secret hard side to you when you're negotiating that we're not seeing?
Oh, no, I am definitely uncompromising in what I expect. And anyone who's listening who's worked in one of my teams before will tell you I'm pretty direct and straight. That's the Dutch directness, they call it, from my father that I've inherited. But, I have a good heart. I have, I want everyone to be happy, but I won't accept fools lightly. And so definitely when it comes to people who work in my teams, I expect them to work as hard as I do. And I work extremely hard. So, I think you have to be firm but fair. It's a little bit like parenting in some ways, but you don't have to be a ruthless business leader like you see on the TV, maybe.
In your childhood, you watched your parents lose everything in a recession. How does that affect the way that you invest now and the safeguards that you put in place for your own family?
Yeah, well, I suppose if my father was sat here answering this question for you, he would probably say the downfall was probably you could probably summarize it as all your eggs in one basket, really. So whether it be businesses, investments, or within the businesses that I run themselves, if we look at all of my businesses, we don't rely on one lead source, on one source of revenue or referrals or whatever the business may be. We diversify. And so, if I use the example of the UK market, it means if we have house builders, estate agents, referral customers, a good web referral system, organic search. It means that, if a house building industry is feeling a painful or a cold 6 months, hopefully some other parts of the pie are able to at least sustain you there. And so I think you just need to think about the worst. I think one of the skills that I'm fairly proud of is that I'm a pretty three-dimensional thinker. So I'll think about the worst as well as the best when I'm trying to make decisions. And if you work it on that way and then try and come up with what's most probable, then you can't go too far wrong.
And have you got any secret business leadery habits? Are you taking ice baths first thing in the morning? Are you up before dawn?
No. Well, I shower every day. Is that one? Does that count? No, nothing like that. I could probably take some advice from some of the business leaders about sleeping less or doing more reading or whatever it may be. But no, I think I just, I think the truth is when you do something that you really enjoy, you don't work a day. And so I get up every day, and I know it sounds cheesy, but I get up every day and I love love what I do. And that's what makes it so easy to achieve so much. That's the truth.
Chris Shoetrips, the man who here in Dubai is running Mortgage Finder for the Property Finder company. Back home, he's got a couple of multi-million pound businesses. And I'm sure that there is a lot more to come because he is 29 years old. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, but that's the bit that is the cherry on the top of this particular story. Thank you very much for joining me this evening. It's been a thoroughly enjoyable chat.
Thank you for having me.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.